Welcome back, everybody. I'm going to finish off metabolism and then do a little molecular biology section. They will have a seminar in here, the Distinguished Scientist Seminar, starting at 4 o'clock, which means we are expendable, i.e. they're kicking us out. So we will do 2 hours here and then move upstairs to the old freshman amphitheater, where apparently that is opening up, and we'll have that for the last 2 hours. Okay? So at least we're in the same building. It's not like we have to go down to the medical center or anything like that, or come in at 6 o'clock on Saturday morning, which would be another option, right? Okay. You should find a page near the end, about the fourth one from the end, where we're talking about important genetic deficiencies and amino acid degradation, all of which are high yield for this exam because it's easy to put into a clinical vignette. Don't forget phenylketonuria, alkaptonuria, and maple syrup urine disease, all of which can be asked. The PMMS pathway, significant because to get from methylmalonyl-CoA to succinyl-CoA, I need B12. Therefore, this reaction will be impaired in a B12 deficient patient and lead to methylmalonic acidemia and eventually methylmalonic aciduria. So we're down here at the bottom. And we looked at the degradation of methionine, which is going in this direction, and said that the key enzyme defect in methionine degradation was cystathionine synthase, which leads, however, to an increase in homocysteine. The homocysteine accumulates in the blood and initially causes vascular problems, so atherosclerosis and thrombolytic occlusions. And as it accumulates to higher levels, it will spill into the urine, causing homocystinuria. And at this case, then, you see dislocated lenses and mental retardation. The treatment here, obviously, the problem is I can't degrade methionine, so I have a diet low in methionine. But the other thing to note is this is the one reaction you should remember that requires B6 as a cofactor. And therefore, not only is methionine restriction beneficial to these kids, but this also is supplementation with B6. Now, we finished off with the reaction going in this direction, simply saying that some of the homocysteine is taken out of the degradative pathway and recycled to methionine. And the enzyme name is not critical here. I will mention it. But the most important thing is this is the only reaction in the body that requires both B12 and folate. The folate is required as a methyl THF, methyl tetrahydrofolate derivative to put a methyl group back on homocysteine to form methionine. For that reason, the enzyme is referred to as homocysteine methyltransferase. However, since methionine is being produced, in first aid for the boards, you may see it as methionine synthase. That's the same enzyme. Methionine synthase in first aid is homocysteine methyltransferase. Now, what can happen then if there's a defect here, meaning a defect of the enzyme, or in fact these particular cofactors? And the thing to note is that you're going to see the same thing here, which you'd expect to see over here. So again, the major problem is going to be vascular, proceeding then if there's an enzyme deficiency that is, in fact, pretty detrimental, dislocated lenses and mental retardation. But the thing to note is this. Here are the differences here. The thing to note is that here, of course, methionine is elevated because it can't be degraded. Here it will be lower than normal because it cannot be recycled. But the other thing to note is this. If I cannot carry out this recycling reaction, the patients present with a megaloblastic anemia, whereas there's no anemia here. Now, why should this happen? And it's very simple to note the following. The reaction really takes homocysteine and methylfolate and converts it to methionine and folate. So this is a way to maintain folate levels inside the cell. Therefore, if there's a defect in this reaction, not only will methionine not be recycled, but folate will not be recycled, and folate levels will go down in the cell. And very simply, folate is required for cell division. It's required, as we'll see, for DNA replication and chromosome duplication, and therefore what tissues in the body will be affected, the most rapidly dividing tissues. And for sure, the first thing you think of is bone marrow. So a defect in this reaction leads to a drop in folate, and therefore leads to what? It leads to a megaloblastic anemia and hypersegmented neutrophils, and these are exactly the things you'd expect to see for what? A folate deficiency. The second thing is, if B12 is required here, then a B12 deficiency should cause what? A folate deficiency. A B12 deficiency here means the reaction will be impaired and folate will not be recycled. And that is why B12 deficient patients present with what? All the symptoms of a folate deficient patient, including megaloblastic anemia, a large cell anemia, hypersegmented neutrophils where they have 6 to 8 lobes on the nucleus instead of the normal 5. But what does a B12 deficiency present with that folate deficiency does not? Methylmalonic acidemia, aciduria, and in fact, neurological problems. That's why the anemia associated with B12 is called pernicious, because it also can involve the nervous system. So this reaction then is not trivial. The two major things that it says is, first of all, both folate and B12 are required to get this to go this way, so a deficiency of either one will cause what? Homocystinemia. But a B12 deficiency will also impair this reaction, causing a folate deficiency, and that is why you see the megaloblastic anemia here. So an important reaction for the B12 and folate requirements, and the fact that homocystinemia accompanies both of these particular vitamin deficiencies. How do you get a folate deficiency? We talked about B12 yesterday. How do you get a folate deficiency? In an adult that's not pregnant, it is alcoholism. It's number two right after thiamine and the Wernicke-Korsakoff syndrome. Of course, you're all aware of the folate requirement in early embryogenesis and during pregnancy as being important to avoid the risk of birth defects. So what's next? Next is the urea cycle, which also has to do with amino acid degradation. Again, the cycle is going to be important primarily because of genetic deficiencies. The thing to note is then there are five enzymes that it can in fact be tested. There are two that are generally tested, and this is the citric or the urea cycle over here, and they may expect you to go around it. The thing to note is that when amino acids are degraded, they generate a toxic product, which is ammonia, shown here. And that has to be detoxified, because if it gets into the systemic circulation, it will cause neurological problems. Amino acids are primarily degraded in the liver 24/7. And therefore, the urea cycle, in fact, works in the liver, which you'd expect, because that's where the ammonia will be generated. In order for the ammonia to be detoxified, it is first converted to something called carbamoyl phosphate. This is done by an enzyme referred to as carbamoyl phosphate synthetase 1. And the 1 says, I'm numero uno, I'm big boy, I'm the guy that participates in the urea cycle. We'll see another one later on. The carbamoyl phosphate then, once it's produced by this carbamoyl phosphate synthetase 1, gets sucked up into the urea cycle, and the urea cycle spins, and out of course comes urea, which is a non-toxic product which can be eliminated by the kidneys. The thing is, I have to carry this into the cycle, and it's carried in the following way. By an enzyme that converts ornithine to citrulline as carbamoyl phosphate then is taken into the cycle. It will spin, and this ornithine as a carrier will be recycled. In case I see this on a monitor, I have to know, is it O going to C or C going to O? And a lot of people have trouble getting started because ornithine and citrulline, they sound the same to me. So I've got to remember this. In terms of an enzyme defect, my high-yield enzyme defect is going to be this second one with the awful name. Ornithine transcarbamylase, so important that it's commonly really abbreviated as OTC. If I can remember, this is the enzyme most likely to be asked as a defect. It also tells me if I see the cycle, I go from O to C, not opposite, ornithine to citrulline. Then what do? The making and breaking of arginine-succinate. Make it with a synthetase, break it with a lyase, and then arginine simply hydrolyzes to produce the urea. The urea that is produced by the urea cycle is sent out into the blood, where clinically it's referred to as the BUN4 blood urea nitrogen. That's because it's detoxified ammonia with nitrogen atoms. And the thing to note then, if there's any defect in this cycle, what are the major labs? there will be elevation of ammonia. It can't get in. So hyperammonemia, that's causing the neurological problems. But the BUN would be abnormally low. I'm not making urea, so it will be abnormally low. Now that's what's shown over here in the lab results. Hyperammonemia and abnormally low BUN, those two things together basically tell you you've got a problem in the urea cycle. Best guess, look at an option list. That's the enzyme that should be there because, in fact, in real life, it's the most common enzyme deficiency. Another thing to note here is plasma and urinary glutamine are abnormally elevated. This is simply another way of saying that there is hyperammonemia. Because when there's too much ammonia in the body, an enzyme called glutamine synthetase tries to detoxify it with the overproduction of glutamine. So elevated glutamine is indicative, in fact, simply of the hyperammonemia. So that should be enough to tell you there's a problem in the urea cycle. What else? The kids are born normal and they're all right for about 48 hours. During that time, they're what? Ingesting formula, which contains not only lactose, but protein. And that's the problem. They're literally protein intolerant. So eventually they simply get sick, they're lethargic, they vomit, and they're irritable. The ammonia is thought to directly stimulate the respiratory center. So they start to blow off CO2 and they develop respiratory alkalosis. Most physicians would agree that hyperammonemia accompanied by respiratory alkalosis is also a dead giveaway. It's the urea cycle. And if not treated, of course, convulsions, cerebral edema, and they can go into a coma and die. The cerebral edema can be significant. Their head actually swells. Now, the thing to note is this is the most common enzyme deficiency, which you'd expect to see. Leads to a hyperammonemia type 2. And the thing to note then is that's the one that should be in the option list. But guess what they've been doing recently? They've been putting that one and this one, which is the second most common deficiency, in the same option list. And they expect you to make a differential diagnosis. Well, the one thing that tells me it's one of these two but is not a differential diagnosis is this. That is, these enzymes exist at the beginning of the cycle. Therefore, their deficiencies lead to the most high levels of ammonia in the blood, and citrulline will be low. Clearly, if there's a block here, citrulline will be low. But how do I make the differential diagnosis then if it's not on the citrulline levels? If the block is here, which is the ornithine transcarbamylase block, carbamyl phosphate cannot get into the cycle. And it flows over into the pyrimidine synthesis pathway to produce orotic acid. We'll look at that in a few minutes. So this occurs only when carbamyl phosphate cannot get into the cycle. So the first way to make the diagnosis is that this ornithine transcarbamylase deficiency is the only defect in the cycle that is also accompanied by an orotic aciduria. For this one here, no orotic aciduria for carbamyl phosphate synthetase. That makes sense. If the block is above this, carbamyl phosphate will not accumulate and will not produce orotic acid. But here with my key enzyme, that's when you see orotic acid. Several students last year from other institutions have told me they saw this, but they were looking for orotic acid and they didn't see it. So how the hell do I make the differential diagnosis? Both of these enzymes are in the same option list and they're not telling me there's orotic acid in the urine. So the second way comes, in fact, from medical genetics. This one is the only enzyme in the urea cycle that shows X-linked recessive behavior. The one at the top, carbamyl phosphate synthetase, is what you'd expect, as an enzyme deficiency should be autosomal recessive. So this is my second enzyme that is weird and showing X-linked recessive behavior. So how was the differential diagnosis made? They showed these folks a pedigree. And what's the pedigree? Is it autosomal or X-linked recessive? It was X-linked recessive. Pretty much males only were affected, and therefore the correct answer was OTC. So OTC is important because, number one, it is the most common deficiency in real life in the urea cycle, and it is the only enzyme deficiency that shows erotic aciduria and X-linked recessive inheritance, and either one can be used to differentiate between the other ones. Generally, these other ones are not known, but it should be obvious if the block is here, citrulline will be too high. If the block is here, arginine succinate will be too high. But these are the ones that should be tested, especially that one here. So those are the important things to note, and you will see one of those. I haven't heard anybody say that they've gone through this exam without seeing a urea cycle enzyme defect. What's the treatment? Of course, if it's severe in the neonatal stage, basically a transfusion or hemodialysis. But the two drugs that are administered IV are benzoic acid or benzoate and phenylacetate. These particular drugs then do what? The benzoate and phenylacetate, after activation of the CoA derivatives, basically get rid of two amino acids. The benzoate targets glycine and gets rid of it as a purate, and the phenylacetate targets glutamine and gets rid of it as phenylacetylglutamine. And why then should that be important? Because these two amino acids, glycine and glutamine, deaminate and generate a lot of ammonia. So what I'm doing basically is, let's get rid of these amino acids, get them out into the urine so they don't deaminate and they don't contribute to the hyperammonemia. Should that then contribute to protein malnutrition and kwashiorkor if I'm in fact getting rid of these amino acids? They're not part of private Tim Hall. They're non-essential, so they can simply be remade if they're needed for protein synthesis. So at least know the two drugs and maybe the targets. Finally, the disease management. Low protein diet supplemented with carbohydrates. Arginine may be supplemented in here because it's part of the cycle, but basically it's simple. It's a low protein diet. How low? These kids are basically allowed one hot dog a week, so it's pretty gross. The oral drug is phenylbutyrate, which is in fact converted to phenylacetate, so it works like this. Why not phenylacetate orally? This stuff stinks. It just does. So put it in IV, you can't smell it. You tip it in your mouth, it's awful. So they give you a prodrug, phenylbutyrate, that's converted to this. So you may want to know clearly that this is protein intolerance, but there are drugs that can be used to treat it. Watch out for ornithine transcarbamylase. Best guess? Going to see it. That leads us to the end then, and that is pyrimidine and purine nucleotide synthesis and degradation. This is the synthesis of pyrimidines. That is the pathway that's going to be most important in terms of pyrimidine metabolism. The first thing to note is, remembering from 2 years ago, if you can, what are my pyrimidine nucleotides? And they are cut. Cytosine, uracil, and thymine. With the thymine being most important in that it is used to make DNA. It's found only in DNA and not in ribonucleic acid, RNA. Now, the pathway is obviously complicated, but the thing to note is I use simply some basic cellular compounds, two amino acids, glutamine, aspartate, carbon dioxide, and I initially make something that is orotic acid or orotate. Because I'm making these pyrimidines starting from glutamine, aspartate, carbon dioxide, this is in fact referred to as a de novo pathway. Now, which cells are going to need this? Again, which cells need these nucleotides? And you're thinking rapidly dividing cells. So nucleotides are needed for cell division. And any problem here, then, will lead to a problem in cell division. Now, what does the uric acid do then? It first forms the U. The U is made first. And then from the U, I get eventually the C. And down here at the bottom, from the U, I get the T. The T is referred to as deoxy because it's going to be produced only as a nucleotide for DNA synthesis, not RNA synthesis. So therefore, what we're seeing here then is just a generalized pathway without any major names here, with orotic acid, a key intermediate, producing the U and then the C and then the T cut in that particular order. Now, one enzyme name needs to be added here. And this is an enzyme that takes this orotic acid and converts it to the U in two steps. And it's simply called UMP synthase. The reason for that is the block is here. And therefore, orotic acid will accumulate, causing orotic aciduria. But that can be differentiated from the urea cycle defect because there will be no hyperammonemia. No hyperammonemia. But what other thing might I expect to see? What I might expect to see is, again, any problem in nucleotide synthesis means rapidly dividing cells will not divide rapidly, meaning what or a particular organ will be mostly affected, the bone marrow, leading to what? Megaloblastic anemia and, in fact, hypersegmented neutrophils. So what we can see here then on the bottom of the same page, there are only two genetic diseases they can give you where the patient presents with this stuff called orotic acid in the urine. The thing to note is, what else does the patient have? What other lab finding is critical? And if the orotic aciduria is accompanied by hyperammonemia, now I know the problem is in the urea cycle. And in fact, not only do I know that a problem is in the urea cycle, it directs my attention to one and one enzyme only, and that is this ornithine transcarbamylase. However, what we're saying now is I have a patient with orotic aciduria, but no hyperammonemia. But instead, the patient presents with a megaloblastic anemia. And when I see that, I'm thinking something is wrong in nucleotide synthesis, and it must be pyrimidine synthesis. How do I know that? Because orotic acid is an intermediate only in pyrimidine, not purine synthesis. So it tells me that's the pathway. And that's often what they'll say. They'll say, there's a little guy who's born, and after a few months, he's not growing properly, and he presents with a megaloblastic anemia. The doctor is smart enough to remember what from basic biochemistry, probably a B12 or a folate deficiency, therefore gives B12 and folate supplements, and the kid's condition does not improve. So what are they saying? The problem is has to be in the pyrimidine biosynthetic pathway, because it's orotic aciduria. And if it's in fact not a genetic or a defect in a vitamin, then it will be what? A problem in the enzyme. And that's the enzyme. This is the way I made sure that you, in fact, added that. Pyrimidine synthesis is the problem if there is megaloblastic anemia, and the enzyme defect is this one called UMP synthase. Come back to the last part in a second. So this is the enzyme defect in your pyrimidine biosynthetic pathway leading to orotic aciduria. But again, because the nucleotides can't be made, this accounts for the bone marrow problems and the megaloblastic anemia. So how is this treated then if it's not treatable by folate or B12 administration? Well, don't forget the block is here. So this is being accumulated. The block is there. Obviously, then, any of these cannot be made. So what is the treatment? The treatment for these kids is simply feed them uridine. Give them U. this bypasses this step and gets converted directly to UMP. And once I get the U, what can I get from the U? The C and the T. So thank heavens the block is up here, because I can add uridine and simply make the UMP by an alternate route. So that's the treatment for these kids, is simply oral uridine. Now the final reaction is also important, and that is shown here, making the T. The T gets made, of course, from the U by an enzyme appropriately named thymidylate synthase. And the thing to note is this. It requires a derivative, which I'm not sure what the name is from this, but I see folate. What this actually stands for is methylene tetrahydrofolate. But they never test what the derivative is. What they do test is in this pyrimidine nucleotide synthetic pathway, folate is needed for the production of T. Now, why then can we say that's important? And the reason is, don't forget, any problem in nucleotide synthesis leads to what? A megaloblastic anemia. And in terms of vitamin deficiencies, you're thinking folate and B12. Question is then, why does a folate deficiency lead to a megaloblastic anemia? And this is the answer. Because folate is needed to make this nucleotide, the T, by the enzyme called thymidylate synthase. So a high-yield question is, in a folate-deficient patient, which of the following enzymes will have lower than normal activity accounting for the megaloblastic anemia? And the enzyme they're looking for is this one. This one will have lower than normal activity because it requires folic acid as a cofactor, and that will lead to what? A lack of T production, and therefore problems in cell division in the bone marrow and megaloblastic anemia. So the pathway could be worse, but realistically is important for two things, and that is erotic aciduria with no hyperammonemia due to an enzyme defect in the pathway itself, and then the folate requirement to make the T by the enzyme thymidylate synthase, explaining why, if there's a folate deficiency, these guys can be made okay, but I can't make the T, and therefore I can't make DNA, and cells will not divide properly. So the last thing you see at the bottom of this page is folate deficiency. The major thing, of course, is megaloblastic anemia. But because the defect presumably is so far down in the pathway, basically the last reaction, you do not see erotic acid accumulation. So erotic aciduria is not a clinical feature of folate deficiency, but this, of course, is classic. So pyrimidine synthesis, folate deficiency, and a UMP synthase genetic deficiency. The last diagram, then, is what about purines? In this case, we're talking about purine synthesis, but not just the synthesis, but also the degradation and the salvage. So what about first, what about the synthesis of these particular purine nucleotides? The synthesis is shown here, which I've color-coded blue. So this is the synthesis here to here. Now what does it tell me? What are my purines? They're not cut. They are A and G, adenine and guanine. Those are the two that are important in terms of producing these nucleotides for both DNA and RNA synthesis. However, I've now put in here, although this is not used to make nucleic acids, another one that's going to be an intermediate here is something called I. So inosine now makes its appearance, even though it's not used to make DNA or RNA. Now, what do? Then I first make a derivative of ribose phosphate, and then in a series of 10 ugly reactions, convert it to not the A and not the G, but first the I. Then the I is used to make the A and is used to make the G. during this particular series of reactions. One key enzyme name needs to be remembered. It's at the beginning. It is called glutamine PRPP amido transferase. That is the only time you'll hear an enzyme called an amido transferase, and this, in fact, is the key enzyme that's regulated in the purine nucleotide synthetic pathway. The other steps that lead to the IMP, all you need to know, there are too many to remember, but it requires glutamine and aspartate, which are common precursors for all the nucleotides, but watch out for this. Glycine is an amino acid that is required specifically for purine synthesis, not pyrimidine. And the synthesis of the IMP also requires folate as a cofactor for enzymes in this pathway that have unpronounceable names. So you won't see them. The only one you'll see that requires folate in nucleotide synthesis is the one that can be pronounced, thymidylate synthase. That's why they'll ask that one. But it does say folate is needed to make the IMP, and since the A and the G are made from the I, then folate is needed to make what? All purine nucleotides, but only the T in the pyrimidine series. Now, the thing to note here is, what about these A and G? What are the bases? This reminds you that a nucleotide is base sugar phosphate, where the sugars are for ribose and a phosphate, a circle P. Well, in AMP, the base should be A, it is, adenine. In GMP, the base should be G, it is, it's guanine. And therefore, in inosine monophosphate, the base should be I, it isn't. It is this, it is H, hypoxanthine. So what I've written here is, this is in fact the structure of IMP. This is IMP. It's a nucleotide, but the base is in fact hypoxanthine. That's hard. A lot of people remember this by just saying, hi, how you doing? H-I. H is the base in something called inosine. H is an I. So this is the synthetic pathway. Any enzyme defects here like you'd expect to see in pyrimidine synthesis? And the answer is no. This is not going to be tested. So therefore, what is the reason I need to remember this? Basically, because this is the site of regulation. And it's very simple. If the purine nucleotides are made in excess of their need to make DNA, they simply shut off this key enzyme so they're not made in excess. The thing to note is that all three of them, as their monophosphates, inhibit that enzyme, and generally this is a good way to test this. Why would IMP inhibit that enzyme? They're saying, do you remember, IMP is a purine nucleotide. IMP is a purine nucleotide. Now, what about the degradation? These things are degraded when they are in excess and therefore not needed for DNA replication. And when I degrade these, I do the following. First of all, I chop off a phosphate here. And therefore, that leaves a base attached to a sugar, and that is a nucleoside. Then I'm going to chop off the sugar, leaving the base. And with the base, I'm going to do one of two things. I'm going to either degrade it and send it down the toilet in the urine, or I'm simply going to take the base and put it right back on PR phosphoribose. If I take the base and put it right back on PR, I reform what? The nucleotide, and that is called salvage. So what about the degradation of these particular nucleotides, which I've color-coded green here? Now we go to the degradation. First of all, I take off the phosphate. This leaves the nucleoside adenosine and the nucleoside guanosine. This isn't that critical. And this is, however, one of these nucleosides has an identity crisis, and it's the A. Adenosine is converted to inosine. This is in the degradative pathway of purine degradation, specifically the A, and this is done by the enzyme adenosine deaminase. Now, the reason this enzyme is critical in degradation is because of this. This is the most common enzyme deficiency leading to severe combined immunodeficiency disease. There are other ways to do it, such as not making proper interleukin receptors and things of that nature, but this is an enzyme deficiency leading to SCID, adenosine deaminase. What happens is, of course, the block is here. Adenosine accumulates, AMP accumulates, ADP accumulates, deoxy-ADP accumulates, deoxy-ATP accumulates, the A nucleotides accumulate. And this presumably occurs in multiple organs in the body. But most of these cell types are resistant. They don't care, except for two. And unfortunately, the two cell types that can't stand this are B and T lymphocytes. So it kills them, leading to the severe combined immunodeficiency disease. So adenosine deaminase in the purine nucleotide degradation pathway, critical because of its effect in the immune system. What happens then once I've got adenosine to inosine and guanosine? These are nucleosides. Now I chop off the sugar. If I chop off the sugar, the G gives me G, guanine. But don't forget, if I chop off the sugar from inosine, I get what? The H. So the bases produced here are hypoxanthine and guanine. These are further degraded through an intermediate known as xanthine and through an enzyme called xanthine oxidase. This is the degradative pathway. And the key thing after all this is over, what do I get? The end product is uric acid. Uric acid. This is the stuff that causes what? Gout. And therefore, this explains why purine degradation leads to gout and not pyrimidine degradation. This is coming from purines, not pyrimidines. So it's the A, the I, and the G, when they're degraded, that produces uric acid. The key thing to get uric acid levels down in the blood from pharmacology, biochemistry, is allopurinol. And you should be aware of the fact that this is a key enzyme inhibitor in the degradative pathway, which is this one to remember, xanthine oxidase. So if I inhibit it, I prevent uric acid production in a patient that has hyperuricemia and gout. Now, when I degrade these particular nucleotides, I get them all the way to their bases and then send them into the degradative pathway. But this actually only occurs about 10% of the time. So what do I do with these bases, hypoxanthine and guanine, the other 90% of the time? And they are sent into salvage. They are sent into salvage. And what it says here, very simply, in a single reaction, hypoxanthine and guanine are put back on ribosphosphate to produce what? The nucleotides. Well, clearly guanine will produce what? GMP, but hypoxanthine will produce IMP. But this is a nice cycling pathway where basically the bases are salvaged and reconverted back to their nucleotides. One enzyme and one enzyme only is required here. It has an awful name, hypoxanthine guanine phosphoribosyl transferase. But at least if I see that in an option list, it says what? Hypoxanthine guanine. Gosh, two bases being recycled, salvage pathway. Now, why is that one so important? Because there are kids that are born with essentially a near complete deficiency of this enzyme. It's essentially gone. So I can't recycle anything. If I can't recycle anything, hypoxanthine and guanine are going to do what? Go into the degradative pathway with production of excess uric acid and seriously a very high probability of gout. And in fact, these little kids die eventually of a gouty nephropathy. It basically kills the kidneys. But what is going to be the major clue that this is the enzyme they're talking about? And that's because of this. Here is your hypoxanthine guanine phosphoribosyl transferase deficiency. It's a mouthful, so it's generally called HGPRT, but won't appear like that in an option list. And this is Leishmanian syndrome. And the thing to note is these kids not only suffer from a urate nephropathy, But these are the little boys that have spastic cerebral palsy, some mental retardation. But most of all, watch out for this. These are the little boys that are, in fact, self-mutilators. So they try to bite off their lips. They try to bite off their fingertips. They're generally put in straints. If you come into the room, they'll try to bite your nose off. Some of them, in fact, this is gross, have their teeth pulled because they know they're going to hurt each other, and this is Lesch-Nyhan syndrome. Why they show this bizarre behavior is not known. Doctors Lesch and Nyhan have been trying to figure it out for 50 years, and so far, no success. However, if you're presented with a little boy that's throwing himself on the ground, pounding his head into the wall, trying to bite his fingertips off, they're telling you this is Lesch-Nyhan syndrome, and then you have to know two things. What pathway is deficient in this kid? Purine salvage. What is the enzyme? Hypoxanthine guanine something A's. Trying to salvage these two bases, which are purines. So that is the important thing to note here. None of this has anything to do with pyrimidines. Finally, I've added this here at the top. Why did I say little boys? This is also X-linked recessive. And then I've added this up here to remind you that enzyme deficiencies are inherited as autosomal recessive traits, except if it's weird. And we've talked about three of them, so here's the summary. Here are the three things we talked about that are enzymes that show X-linked recessive inheritance. First of all, G6PDH, glucose-6-phosphate dehydrogenase. These are the males that are affected by what? Oxidant-induced episodes of hemolytic anemia. OTC. We just mentioned it. This is the one enzyme in the urea cycle that's X-linked recessive inheritance. They've shown pedigrees on this. And now I've added the third and final one, and that is this enzyme in purine salvage, HGPRT. Two final points then. Anytime you get excess uric acid production, clearly there is hyperuricemia and a tendency to gout. Allopurinol is going to bring the uric acid level down, and therefore prevent a second attack. Key things from pharmacology/biochemistry, when there is an inflammatory attack, what is the most likely joint to be affected? The big toe. Secondly, to make the diagnosis, you stick a needle into the joint, pull out some synovial fluid, and look under a polarizing microscope for certain crystals. In an exam question, those crystals will be defined as needle-shaped and bifringent. The reason that you have to make that diagnosis, there's pseudogout, which is accumulation not of uric acid in the joint, but accumulation of calcium pyrophosphate. And then a final question I've heard recently, what do you do for the inflammatory attack? Someone's coming in with pain. You don't give allopurinol. That's just to make sure they don't have a second one. So what do you do to treat it? You can give them either colchicine or an NSAID, generally indomethacin. And however, guess what they've been telling me? Both of those appear in an option list with this type of question. So what is the drug of choice? What do you choose? They both work well. Choose indomethacin. Colchicine works great, but has serious GI problems, including bloody diarrhea. So gout, from biochemistry point of view, pharmacology, whatever, pathology, is going to be high yield. This case then, don't forget your adenosine deaminase deficiency, but the real high yield question here is in fact purine salvage and this self-mutilation behavior accompanied by a gouty situation. All right, guys, that finishes metabolism. I have about 20 after, so we'll take a 10-minute break, come back and look at the first part of our molecular biology, and then, of course, we will move upstairs. Of course, we could just shut the lights out and just not move and see what happens. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to go ahead and do this.
Okay, guys, we'll look at some molecular biology. Generally, they just want the basic concepts, which is nice because they could get totally ridiculous, in which case nobody would get anything right. So basically, they're making sure that you understand that when cells divide, they have to duplicate their chromosomes, and that involves DNA replication. So they want you to know some details about DNA replication in rapidly dividing cells. They want you to know about DNA damage and repair. And repair systems involved in cancer. So basically, it's a tie-in with medical genetics. And then in terms of the rest of molecular biology, they really are concerned with how genes are expressed. And that means transcription followed by translation and maybe something to do with genetic mutations, the type of mutations you'd expect to see in genes that lead to problems in transcription and production of a normal protein. So all we're showing here then is, first of all, what about DNA replication? What about DNA repair? Then we'll go upstairs. Maybe we won't get through repair. Doesn't matter. We'll go upstairs and look at transcription and translation, gene expression, and then, of course, we'll do some questions. So this then just reminds you then of a strand of nucleic acid or nucleotides linked together. So I see base sugar phosphate, those are nucleotides. When the nucleotides are linked together, they're linked together by so-called phosphodiester bonds. And this then gives us a strand of nucleic acid. If it's a strand of DNA, which is shown here, the main thing to note is the base thymine. So there will be an A and a G and a C, but there is thymine, which is a base that is specific for DNA. The next thing to note is the sugar is a DR, not just an R for ribose, and this stands for deoxyribose. That's because here there is simply a hydrogen and not an oxygen. So things to note, first of all, thymine for sure, and then what? The lack of an oxygen here, so the sugar is actually deoxyribose. When the strand of DNA forms, the ends are different. This is a phosphate here and a hydroxyl here. This is referred to as a 5' end, and this as a 3' end. And the thing they'll want you to know is, what is the nucleotide, i.e. base sequence? And the thing to note, remember, is how do I read it? Do I read it from 5' to 3', or vice versa? You always think 5' to 3'. So the sequence here will be ACGT, not the reverse, because I start at the 5' end and work my way down to the 3' end. Since this produces a sugar phosphate backbone, it is the bases that tell me the sequence. So base sequence is synonymous with nucleotide sequence. Now in single strands of DNA, basically they may test one thing from virology. The classic virus that has a single strand of DNA is parvo. Other ones, generally double-stranded, that's the one that's most likely to be tested. If it is a double-stranded DNA, which is shown here, this could be viruses, but it also is all cellular DNA. So any DNA coming out of a cell, whether it's a human cell or a bacterial cell, is automatically double-stranded. And what they expect you to know here is that when double-stranded forms, the strands run in opposite directions and undergo what is referred to as complementary base pairing. You have to remember that complementary base pairing involves your base pairing rules, A's with T's, T's with A's, C's with G's, and G's with C's. So you've got to know your base pairing. Other ways that this has come up in questions, remember, this can be referred to as annealing or hybridization. So one strand is base paired with the other, annealed with the other, hybridized with the other, three ways of saying the same thing. So I got to know my base pairing rules, and I have to know that they are running in opposite directions. This is simply a nice thing to remember then. They may give me a sequence and label the ends, in which case I know which end is which. But the important thing to note is this. More than likely, in the stem and in the option list, they're going to give me a sequence that is unlabeled. And I've got to think which end is which. And this is what you think. When I see an unlabeled sequence, the 5' end will be left and the 3' end will be right. If they want to switch it around, they have to label those ends. So they will show you a sequence in a question that looks like this, and then they'll show you a bunch of options that also will look like this. And the first thing you do to make sure you get the right answer is simply think, everything's unlabeled, so everything will have 5' left. Everything has 5' left if it is unlabeled. Sometimes the phosphodiester PDA bond is shown. These are little PPs. That's not important. It's the big A's. And then the thing to note here, strands must be anti-parallel to base pairs, T's with A's, C's with G's. This is what you'd expect to see going in opposite directions. How are they held together? They're held together by hydrogen bonds, shown here as dashed lines, and I see two lines between the T's and the A's and three between the C's and the G's. This tells me which base pairs are tighter than the others. GCs are tighter, 3 hydrogen bonds are tighter than 2. Of course, that implies that ATs are weaker than CGs. That is also tested. In certain physiological processes, the two strands of DNA have to separate. What type of sequences would you expect to see to get the strands separated easily? Lots of ATs. So they simply check that you know ATs are looser than CGs. CGs are more tight. This also has also been tested. It says that in double-stranded DNA, if T base pairs with A and C with Gs, then their percentages must be equal. Question is, I've isolated DNA from a bacterium. That's a cell, so automatically I know it's double-stranded. There is 10% A. What is the percent G? 10% A, so I know automatically there is 10% T. They have to be the same. So ATs are 20%, CGs are 80%. Correct answer, 40%. I have a sample of DNA that contains 10% A and 20% T. Something is screwy. What's screwy? The A's and T's don't balance. So they tell me what? It's not double-stranded, it's single-stranded. Lastly, in this diagram here, this is a strand of RNA, and everything's exactly the same except for the following. And that is, the sugar is not deoxy, but it is ribose. That's because there's an extra hydroxyl. And the other major thing to note is this. Thymine is not present. It is the U. It is uracil. And they can test this in the following way. Many biochemists that write questions for this exam think, well, if it's not a genetic defect, how the hell do I make this relevant? And they really suffer. I mean, how do I make biochemistry relevant? Drugs and bugs, that's easy. This makes you sick. This gets you better. What the heck do I do with this? So they put it into a research laboratory thing. A researcher is looking at the rate of DNA replication in rapidly dividing cells in culture and would like to measure specifically the production of DNA, which radio-labeled precursor might he or she put in the growth medium to look specifically at DNA synthesis. And they're looking for what? Radioactive T. Testing that. T goes into DNA and U goes into RNA. So this is DNA specific and this is RNA specific. Secondly, if I've got RNA base paired with another strand of RNA, I can't see a T base pairs because there's no T. So what am I going to see? CGs and A, U base pairs. Which one do you think are weakest? AUs are weaker than CGs. CGs are always the tight ones. So I'd be looking for AU base pairs. So that's some basic things that we've talked about, and they have asked questions like this. They've had to ask questions like this, and we'll see some later on. And don't forget the thymine and uracil distinction. Finally, something at the top. They're now starting to ask this. If you were to analyze your DNA, which methylated base would you expect to see primarily in that hydrolysate? And the thing to note is this. This is commonly methylated in sequences referred to as CG islands. So they can test then what is the most common methylated base, and it's methyl C. It's a methylated derivative of C. Secondly, what is it good for? It turns genes off. So if methyl C occurs in gene regulatory regions, the genes turn off. And they can test this in a couple ways. They may just say a patient has a genetic deficiency called Fragile X syndrome, where the regulatory region is hypermethylated. What will be the problem in that patient? And all they want to know is the patient can't make the protein because the gene is turned off. Or they may go to medical genetics and say something like imprinting. Imprinting is what? Turning specific genes off either in sperm or ova. Right? Angelman syndrome, something like that. How would I turn that gene off? By adding a methyl group. Let's give it a fancy name. Let's call it imprinting. So something of that nature. And then finally, the correlation to metabolism. Where's that methyl group coming from? Sam, the methyl man, is my methylating agent. So don't forget about this. Methylcytosine, genes off, maybe something to do with Sam. Very common type of modification to regulate gene expression. All right, the next page then deals with the replication of chromosomes, which are needed for cells to divide. This brings us to the topic of DNA replication. What is shown here on the left is a circular double-stranded chromosome. You're thinking bug. And here is a linear double-stranded chromosome. You're thinking the human nucleus. So these are autosomes or X and Y. What I'm trying to do is replicate them, that is, make one into two when a cell divides into two. So DNA replication goes with cell division. It's chromosome duplication. In either case, whether I'm starting with a circle or a linear chromosome, what I'm going to do is this. I'm going to take the original chromosome and copy both of those strands. This involves then new DNA synthesis, which I've shown here as a new strand of DNA, which I've color-coded green. Therefore, since both strands of the old chromosome are copied, what do I call those old strands? Question I'm asking is, what do you call any strand of nucleic acid that's copied? It's called a template strand. So during DNA replication, both strands of the original chromosome are copied to produce two new chromosomes, and therefore these strands both serve as so-called template strands. The new chromosomes then have an old strand and a newly synthesized one, and this is referred to as semi-conservative DNA replication. Here is the example we see here in a linear chromosome in our nucleus. And what we do here is the same thing, copy both of the strands. So I produce two chromosomes, one shown here and one shown here, containing an old strand and a newly synthesized strand. So this is also semi-conservative. Thing to note then, when these linear chromosomes are reproduced, they're held together by a centromere, so they are referred to as sister chromatids. However, when the cell divides, this chromatid goes into one cell and becomes a bona fide linear chromosome. This goes into another cell and becomes a bona fide linear chromosome. In either case then, semi-conservative replication is the rule. Now, how do I start? I have to start at a particular site referred to as an origin of replication. These are generally referred to as ORI sites. In the single bacterial chromosome in the cytoplasm, there is one origin of replication on the chromosome. So it only can start one place. But on our linear nuclear chromosomes, it can start multiple places on, in fact, the same chromosome. For example, which autosome is the longest one in your nucleus? It's chromosome number 1. That's because the DNA double helix is longest in that chromosome. And in that case, then, it's been estimated on chromosome 1 there are at least 200 origin of replications. Why so many? Speed. How long does it take a mucosal cell to divide into two? About 1 day. And during that 1 day, how long does it take those 43 chromosomes and 46 chromosomes and make them into 46 double chromosomes? About 8 hours. So therefore, that's why I have these multiple origins of replication. Question is asked then, what if I just had this one? Could I still replicate that chromosome? Would that mucosal cell divide? The answer is yes, but not in 24 hours, in a week. So it simply makes things happening at a decent rate. Now, how does this happen to this origin of replication? I need an enzyme to take it apart. And the enzyme that takes it apart is appropriately named helicase because it's separating the strands of a DNA double helix. What would you expect to see at these origin of replication to facilitate the separation? A's, T's, G's, C's, C's, T's. Like to see lots of A's. CGs are too tight, and the other ones, of course, don't obey your base-pairing rules. So I separate them at this particular origin of replication. However, one helicase is not sufficient. It, in fact, requires two. So shown here is an origin of replication where one helicase enzyme, which I'll simply draw here, and another helicase enzyme, which I'll simply draw here. One moves in this direction to the left, and one moves in this direction to the right. So the separation is occurring as the helicases are moving in two directions, left and right. For that reason, then, in all systems, DNA replication is bidirectional. So I'm separating them here. What do I call these here? Where the new DNA is produced, it's called replication forks. Now, what I see at a replication fork, basically an origin of replication, is this. And believe it or not, they've actually projected that image on a monitor. What it says is, I've separated the old strands. That is, this one is the old one, this one isn't. And these represent the new DNA that's being made. When I see an arrow, it tells me that's the direction of synthesis. and the arrowhead is always 3'. So whenever I see an arrow, I know the arrowhead is 3', and the other end then must be 5'. So the synthesis of new strands always occurs 5' to 3'. 5' to 3'. So this is then what you'd expect to see. Generally, if they show an image, they show half of it. So here is the left half showing a piece of DNA being made here that's complementary to this particular strand of the old chromosome, because that's the arrowhead I know this is, 5', and that is 3'. Now, this is being copied. What does copying mean? And very simply, it means base pairing. So if this is 5' and this is 3', then clearly this top strand must be oriented how? Why is that? Why is this here and this here? Everything that's being made here is 5' to 3', right to left, so this has to be oriented in the opposite direction. Now, what one sees if one looks at either one of these replication forks, this one or that one, it doesn't matter. I see a nice long piece of DNA being made here, and here I see a bunch of short pieces being made. They expect you to know, what does that mean? It means the DNA that is made in the new chromosomes is made in two different ways. If it's made as a nice long piece, that is called leading strand synthesis. If it's made as short pieces, that is called lagging strand synthesis. They are identified by looking at a replication fork. Note that when a long leading strand is made, it's always made going into a replication fork. The little strands that are made in pieces, the lagging strands, are coming out of a replication fork. Is that true for the other one if they show me the other half? You bet. Remember, everything's moving right here. Look at the long piece, the leading strand being made into it, the short pieces being made coming out of it. So that is generally how things are being made. Obviously, when I do this, everything has to be linked up, meaning these fragments have to be linked up and attached to this long piece here. So I need an enzyme to connect pieces, what do you call an enzyme that ligates fragments together, clearly DNA ligase. Now, what do I call these little pieces? Anybody know what the little pieces are called? Okazaki fragments. These are Okazaki fragments. The little pieces coming out of the replication fork. This is the leading strand, this is the continuous strand, and not the lagging strand, which is the Okazaki fragments. Note again that the arrowhead is always 3', and 5' then is the other end in the direction of synthesis. Now, what enzymes make the DNA? They are, of course, called DNA polymerases. Thing to note here with DNA polymerases, the DNA is always made 5' to 3'. And that means, very simply, nucleotides are added one at a time to which end? The 3' end, one at a time to this end. Meaning when the new strand is made, the 5' end is made first and the 3' end is made last. But nucleotides are added to the 3' end right there. However, this has to have a particular sequence. And how does DNA polymerase know which nucleotide to add here? Meaning, how do I get the right sequence of the newly synthesized strand? And of course, it copies a template. But the template is copied by base pairing and therefore must be oriented how? In the opposite direction, because of base pairing requires that the two strands, in fact, run in opposite directions. So a template is copied 3' to 5'. What are the substrates? The substrates are triphosphates, although monophosphates, nucleotides, are put into the strand. And the thing to note here is, How do I know this is DNA being made? First of all, note that all of the substrates are little d for what? Deoxy. And the next thing to note is this is a base that's being used, and I see what? The T. So another way they can test you, do you know that DNA requires T and deoxynucleotides, just substrates for these enzymes, DNA polymerases? And now then comes two features that I've got to remember. These are features that are specific with DNA polymerases, and that's this and this. In order for DNA polymerases to get started, they require something referred to as a primer, which during DNA replication in vivo is in fact a little piece of RNA. Now, what does that mean? It means then, if I look at this replication fork, this represents newly synthesized DNA. So I'm going to just copy this. This is newly synthesized DNA. So what does it mean when I need a primer to get started? A little piece of RNA is produced here first. So a little piece of RNA is base paired to the old chromosome, and now DNA polymerase can make DNA by extending the primer. Therefore, if synthesis always occurs 5 prime to 3 prime, primers are always found at what? The 5 prime end, because that's where things start. That is RNA inside cells, and clearly then what I need to do as chromosomes duplicate, I've got to remove this RNA eventually because I don't want RNA in new chromosomes. So I need to know required primers. In cells duplicating chromosomes, it's RNA. What about this DNA shown here? DNA can be used as a primer to get DNA polymerases started in a test tube. And the technique, that's just generally the polymerase chain reaction. Polymerase chain reaction, I use primers, but I can use DNA. The technician makes them for you. Here an RNA polymerase makes that RNA. And then finally, if a mistake is made, these polymerases proofread their work. And simply look at this. This is DNA polymerase is making a strand of DNA by doing what? Adding nucleotides one at a time to the 3' end. And it does so because it knows its base pairing rules. Sees a T, I'll put in an A. See a G, I put in a C. I see a T, I put in a C. Oh, I've screwed up. Polymerase can make a mistake. That is called a mismatch. And when that happens, it basically goes into backspace mode and cuts off the bad nucleotide and starts again. This is referred to as the proofreading activity of DNA polymerases. And if the nucleotide is added to the 3' end, where am I going to cut it off? It's not right, the 3' end. It literally goes into backspace mode. This is the proofreading activity you need to remember. To cut off a single nucleotide from the end of a strand of DNA is referred to as exonuclease activity. This thing is cutting it off from the 3' end, so it's referred to as a 3' exonuclease activity. But the full thing to note here is 3' to 5' indicating that the enzyme has in fact gone into backspace mode, backs up, chop it off, and start again and make sure you get it right. If you simply know this little thing here, it's easy. The primer is going to start there, and proofreading activity is here. Yes? Not hard. Now, what about RNA polymerases? These guys, of course, are producing in DNA replication. RNA polymerases are most important for gene expression because they make an RNA copy of a double-stranded DNA gene. But the thing to note is they make RNA and copy then a gene, a template strand, which of course is, for the most part, DNA. So note some terminology here. This guy would be called a DNA dependent, that's what I'm copying, DNA polymerase, that's what I'm making. What would I call this guy? A DNA dependent, that's what I'm copying, RNA polymerase, that's what I'm making, because that's what RNA polymerases make, RNA. The thing to note is the substrates are also triphosphates, but they are not deoxy, so I see no little D's, and I see this. Why that? Again, reminding you, RNA needs the U, not the T. Finally, why did I emphasize DNA polymerases here? Because RNA polymerases do not show that feature. It doesn't require a primer to get started, and if it makes a mistake, too bad. It just keeps on going. The reason being that if RNA polymerase makes a bad RNA transcript, the next time it gets it right, and the next time it gets it right. But if DNA polymerase makes a mistake, what am I going to get? Mutated chromosomes in new cells, and therefore an increased risk of a genetic mutation. So these things are important, especially don't forget these two things about DNA polymerases only. Hopefully they won't show you a diagram, but generally they like to, and this is the one they like to show. Don't forget the long strand is going into a fork, the short strands are coming out, these are the Okazaki fragments, and what am I showing here? This is RNA primers at the 5' end. They have to be at the 5' end because synthesis occurs 5' to 3', and therefore the 5' ends are made first. Next page basically summarizes a bunch of things they can ask about DNA replication, meaning what's going on in rapidly dividing cells when they duplicate their chromosomes. Here is a comparison of what's happening in a bacterial cell and a eukaryotic cell nucleus. So these are my linear chromosomes. In terms of DNA replication in prokaryotes, what's a subcellular compartment? It will be the cytoplasm. Obviously, no nucleus in a prokaryotic bacterial cells. So what we're saying here is, they may just ask a question about DNA replication. And in the option list, they're looking for the name of a protein or enzyme that goes with that process. So I'm thinking logically, I've got to separate the two strands at a replication origin. That is done, of course, by the enzyme helicase. One goes left, one goes right. However, when I separate the two strands, they're going to want to come back together in base pair. So I've got to keep them apart so they can be copied. That's done by a protein called single-strand binding protein, or SSB. Now that I've got the strands separated and kept separated, I can copy them with DNA polymerases. What do all DNA polymerases need to get started? Primers. So an RNA primer has to be made for them, and that's by an enzyme called primase. So it doesn't matter what cell I'm looking at, helicase, SSB, and primase are key enzymes I put with DNA replication. Now, if they get snarky, they will go to the middle and show me something like this, and basically now start asking me, what are the DNA polymerases that are needed to replicate bacterial and human chromosomes? This reminds me that there's a leading strand and a lagging strand, and the Okazaki fragments are associated specifically with the lagging strand. But in bacteria, there are multiple DNA polymerases that are identified with Roman numerals. And it's not polymerase 1, it's not polymerase 2, it's DNA polymerase 3 that makes everything. So DNA polymerase 3 makes both the leading and the lagging strands in the bacterial cytoplasm. Well, what about in our nuclei? Remember, this is our nuclei. It says here we also have multiple DNA polymerases, but they've been given the names of the Greek alphabet. So there's alpha, beta, gamma, delta, epsilon, I don't know how many now, maybe 15 of them. The thing to note is, at least know four. Put down these four, alpha, beta, gamma, and delta. the very first one and the very last one in this four sequence, Alpha and Delta, replicate our nuclear genome. So it's shown here as Delta with the leading strand and Alpha with the other, but in fact, we can now add this. They work together. So I've got to identify DNA polymerases replicating nuclear chromosomes as Alpha and Delta. What about leading and lagging? I don't care because both of them are needed to do it. What about these other two? Beta is repair. Watch out for this one, gamma. The reason is this one is not even in the nucleus. It's in your mitochondria. So it is not involved in nuclear chromosome replication. It is involved specifically in your mitochondrial genome being replicated. Once I've got these new strands produced, either a leading or short Rogozaki fragments, I've got to remove the primers. This is done by a 5' exonuclease activity. Generally, they won't test what enzyme does this. However, you should note that the activity is 5' exonuclease because primers are always at the 5' end. Then I've got to, in fact, replace that DNA, RNA, with DNA. That's a polymerase. Again, they won't test that. But I've got to join the Okazaki fragments, and they will request this. You've got to remember the name of that enzyme we talked about, and that is ligase. Finally, at the bottom, two things that have importance. One of which is basically pharmacology, and the other is maybe pathology. Supercoils are occurring ahead of these advancing replication forks. Remember, helicases bind to the origin of replication, and then each move in a different direction, one left, one right. And they're separating the strands for DNA replication. But as they separate the strands and move, the DNA in front of these helicases gets all overwound, gets tightened up. This is referred to as positive supercoiling, and if I don't remove those, the helicases will eventually stall. They will simply stop working because there's too much junk in front of them caused positive supercoils. So I need an enzyme to precede each helicase and remove the supercoils produced by those helicases. And they are called, in either case, topoisomerase 2. In bacterial cells, because of a mechanism of action that's a little different from our topo II, this is also called DNA gyrase. This is the target of your fluoroquinolone drugs. Basically, you're looking for something with a floxacin in it. One of them is shown here, norfloxacin, but of course there's cipro, afloxacin. Anything that's got a floxacin in it nowadays is this target. So they expect you to know this is the mechanism by which these antibiotics work, simply by stopping DNA replication, but where the DNA gyrase, which is a topo II, and they do expect you to know these mean the same thing. Topo II in our cells is not called DNA gyrase, but is inhibited by these chemotherapeutic drugs that may also be tested, but generally they focus on the floxacin antibiotics and DNA gyrase. Then finally here, synthesis of telomeres. What are telomeres? Telomeres are the end of linear chromosomes. Our DNA polymerases, Alpha and Delta, make the new chromosomes. But when they get to the ends, they can't make that DNA called telomeres. So they have to do what? Call on a special enzyme to make telomeres. And that one is, of course, called telomerase. That's not required in bacteria because there are no telomeres. There are no telomeres. The ends are joined together. form a circle, no telomeres. So I need telomerase in our cells. Now the thing to note is this, I've added this. This is thought to represent the enzyme, and inside is a single strand of RNA. And what this enzyme is going to do is simply put a sequence of DNA on the ends of chromosomes called telomeres. How does it know what sequence to add? And it copies this piece of RNA inside the enzyme itself. So the enzyme binds to the end, copies this RNA, and puts in what? The correct sequence at the end of chromosomes called a telomere. Weird, but we'll see where that can be tested. Two other things with telomerase that have been asked. Pharmacology, cancer cells. This particular enzyme then is expressed at high levels in cancer cells. That means the ends are always made, and the cells then divide. They become immortal. So this is a good target for developing chemotherapeutic agents. But in other cells that are not immortal, what happens during cell division? Telomerase activity disappears. And therefore, during every round, the chromosomes get shorter, until genes are lost to the extent that the cell dies. So a loss of telomerase is associated with cell aging. Think then very simply how they may test this enzyme. Aging activity goes down, cancer activity goes up. Very simple, but they can ask that. Finally, other DNA polymerases. This reminds you that polymerase gamma is in the mitochondrion. And then something from virology, generally for something referred to as HIV infection, which of course is important, and that is the enzyme referred to as reverse transcriptase. Basically, they want you to know, what is it? And everybody knows HIV is an RNA retrovirus. Therefore, reverse transcriptase should be an RNA polymerase, which will be in the option list and will be wrong. And it's very simple. If you remember, RNA that is put inside an infecting lymphocyte is copied by reverse transcriptase into a double-stranded DNA referred to as complementary DNA. So look what's happening here. The enzyme is making DNA, not RNA. It's copying it. So the correct terminology here is what? An RNA-dependent DNA polymerase. It's a DNA polymerase. So two questions. Does reverse transcriptase entering an infected lymphocyte, does it need a primer to get started? It's too hard. Yes, because this is a DNA polymerase, and all DNA polymerases need a primer to get started. So in fact, the virus brings a primer into the infected cell so reverse transcriptase can get started. Why do we have so much trouble making a vaccine to HIV? Because there's a high rate of mutation. And one of the reasons is reverse transcriptase does not proofread its work. It's a DNA polymerase that unfortunately doesn't have a DNA proofreading activity. Question. Which of the following activities is lacking from reverse transcriptase? The question is, do you remember what the proofreading activity of a DNA polymerase is called? 3' exonuclease activity. So they are testing, do you know those two features of DNA polymerases? They need primers to get started, and they proofread their work with a so-called 3' exonuclease activity, which is lacking, unfortunately, in this enzyme in HIV. Finally, note telomerase here, an enzyme with a piece of RNA inside it that is being copied to make what? DNA at the end of chromosomes. So the enzyme is an RNA-dependent DNA polymerase. Therefore, telomerase is a reverse transcriptase. Something should be on that particular page in your notes. And something on that should appear on the examination. Obviously, we're talking about what? Rapidly dividing cells. Yeah. Sorry? Telomerase? Not that I'm aware of. The reason is it puts on a whole block at once, but it doesn't, a nucleotide at a time. So my guess would be it probably does, because if it puts in the wrong base, it'll take it out. So even though it puts in a complete sequence, it's actually seven nucleotides, it still has to put them on one at a time. So in principle, it could make a mistake and then cut it off. Would you expect it? I don't know the answer for sure, but would you expect it? Yes, why? Because it's a DNA polymerase, and DNA polymerases proofread their work. But it's a DNA polymerase, because reverse transcriptase are RNA-dependent DNA polymerases. Don't forget what it's making, the end of your chromosomes, which hopefully is DNA. Yeah? You don't want RNA in your chromosomes. All right, the next thing here is something to do with DNA repair and problems in the DNA repair systems. Certain types of damage are going to be important, and DNA repair is required to clean up the damage. Why is it here? Because if DNA repair systems are not allowed to correct mistakes, then the mistakes are handed down from cell to cell to cell, generation to generation, and there's accumulation of mutations. And in fact, the risk then increases for cancer. So if there's a problem in a DNA repair system where it has been identified, I'm going to see some type of cancer. Now what I see here is four. Three of them generally can be asked, and two of them are important from biochemistry, pathology, medical genetics. From any one of these, you've heard it probably from either one. The first is this. That's why I've added number one. This is very high yield. And that is a particular type of DNA damage referred to as the production of thymine dimers, which you may recall are pyrimidines. So these are pyrimidine dimers. What causes it? UV radiation, fancy way of saying what? Sunlight. So this is a specific type of damage caused by sunlight. And there are only two organs in the body exposed to sunlight, your skin and your cornea. So you'd expect then those are the two particular organs that will be affected. They are. And if there is a defect in this particular system, meaning this repair system, what do I see is xeroderma pigmentosum. So there's your high-yield disease. This, of course, is a heavily pigmented dermis, a very dry dermis, and corneal ulceration. But if this is going to be some type of cancer clinical vignette, this is going to be a little kid with skin cancer. And it can be any of the skin cancers, squamous cell, basal cell, melanoma, any of them, little kid with multiple skin cancers. What's the problem? It's a deficiency of the repair system, and this is the one enzyme they expect you to know. Excision endonuclease, which cuts out the bad stuff, which of course are the thymine dimers. That leaves a gap in a chromosome. How do I fill that gap? Note here, in all repair systems, DNA polymerases and DNA ligases work together. And therefore, they're common in all of these repair systems, even though their major role is thought to be DNA replication. So know what type of damage is caused by sunlight, the organ systems that are affected, xeroderma pigmentosum, and don't forget that enzyme. That's the one they want you to remember is deficient in this particular disease. The second one important is down here. This involves mismatch repair, and that is because during the copying of chromosomes, during cell division, DNA polymerase, as you know, proofread their work, so they try not to make mistakes. But the chromosomes they're copying are so long that once in a while they make a mistake and they simply don't correct it. So they can in fact cause so-called mismatches because they don't reuse their proofreading activity to correct it. So I need a repair system simply called mismatch repair. The thing to note is, what is it involved in? DNA replication errors. DNA replication errors. Now, during the cell cycle, which is shown down here, G1 is a gap phase where these cells are simply doing their own thing, that is their cellular business, whatever it is. But when they have to duplicate their chromosomes, they carry out DNA synthesis, and that's done in S phase. And then what do? They go into a G2 phase where they rest, but basically they check this. Have these chromosomes been duplicated properly? And if not, then I need a repair system here to correct it. And this, of course, is mismatch repair. Generally, that's all they want you to know. What is mismatch repair good for, and where does it happen during cell division? However, if you see something like this in an option list, HMSH2 or HMLH1, these are the actual proteins that participate in this particular repair system. They have awful names, but they are homologs of what's been found in bacteria. So this one is called human mutant homolog 2, human mutant homolog L, whatever. If I see something like that, that simply goes with mismatch repair. What happens here is a cancer, but it's located in the GI tract. And in fact, the colorectal cancer is referred to as hereditary non-polyposis. I'm sure you heard of that just recently in medical genetics. Hope you did. Here it is again. This is also discovered by Dr. Lynch, so this is now sometimes being referred to as Lynch syndrome. So this is a colorectal cancer without polyps. What's the problem? A deficiency in a so-called mismatch DNA repair system. The third thing is shown here, not as important as the first two, because this is skin cancer, colorectal cancer, and this is simply a cytosine deamination. This has not given any clinical correlation, as far as I know, has not been correlated with any type of cancer. So why, in fact, would they test it? Because it happens so often. It happens about 10,000 times a day in all of us. And that is called cytosine deamination. The main thing to remember is, if you deaminate C, what do you get? You get U. So I simply got to remember this. If I deaminate C, I get U. And if that's occurring a lot during a day, then what is being produced in DNA is U, which can't be there, right? It's got to be in RNA. So I need an enzyme that literally goes around looking at our chromosomes, looking for U. And that enzyme is called uracil glycosylase. This removes the uracil, and then, of course, the break is fixed as it should be. So DNA repair then, you're thinking, something to do with xeroderma pigmentosum and skin cancer, high yield, something to do with mismatch repair that's faulty and Lynch syndrome, and maybe something to do with cytosine deamination where they're testing me, do I know what happens when cytosine deaminates? I get you. Again, the cell cycle. When thymine dimers are formed with xeroderma pigmentosum, cytosines deaminate, they're occurring here. And then this is where I get my chromosomes being replicated. Mismatch repair must come after this, because that's what it does. It corrects mistakes that the polymerases don't have. Finally, from pathology, you need to remember your tumor suppressor genes. From what I've been able to understand, they're now basically trying to get you to identify specific tumor suppressor genes with certain types of cancer. These are ones that even biochemists can remember, the P53 gene and Lee-Fraimeni syndrome, the automatic teller machine, which actually stands for ataxia telangiectasia, correlation with lymphoma, the retinoblastoma gene. These are all what? Producing so-called tumor suppressor proteins, which, as the name implies, suppresses tumor formation. What you're thinking is these particular genes produce proteins that inhibit cell division. Now, why are they shown here? Because if DNA damage is detected, these particular genes stop the cell from dividing to give the DNA repair systems time to do what? Clean up the mess. So if there's a problem in a tumor suppressor gene, DNA damage cannot be corrected simply because the cell can't stop dividing. And therefore, as you see here, as you might expect, there's a correlation between tumor suppressor loss or inactivation and, of course, the development of certain types of cancer. So keep in mind which tumor suppressor genes, here's a partial list, go with which type of cancers. If the pathologist told you more in your pathology course, remember it. If you haven't reviewed it for a while, go back and look at it, because these are now becoming important. That finishes what? That finishes the section on DNA replication and repair. That means it should be close to getting kicked out time. It is, so we will leave in a peaceful manner. Ugh.